Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on January 12, 2012, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on interstate compacts. My name is Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of the Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Two quick announcements before we begin. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. Also, this call is being recorded for possible future use as a podcast or other online use. We have two speakers today. Each will be making opening remarks not longer than some 5 to 7 minutes, after which we're going to have some discussion, including your questions. Michael Greva is the John G. Searle Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he specializes in constitutional law, courts, and business regulation. His most recent work is, in fact, upcoming, a book titled The Upside Down Constitution, which is available for pre-order on Amazon.com. Nick Dranius holds the Clarence J. and Catherine P. Duncan Chair for Constitutional Government and is director of the Joseph and Dorothy Donnelly Moeller Center for Constitutional Government at the Goldwater Institute. Prior to joining the Goldwater Institute, Mr. Dranius was an attorney with the Institute for Justice. Now, their more complete bios are available in the promotional materials sent to you earlier, so I won't go into any greater detail on their backgrounds. And with that, Michael, if you could get us started with your opening remarks.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Dean, and hi, Nick. Look, I'll keep this very short and thought I'd just say a few words about sort of the basic constitutional structure of which the Compact Clause of Article 1, Section 10 is a part. And the reason why it's important, I think, to start at that end is that the Supreme Court has not the slightest comprehension of what this thing means and what it's supposed to do. So start with a basic constitutional arrangement concerning the relation between federal law and state law. The basic rule is, of course, that of the Supremacy Clause, any validly enacted federal law breaks any and all state law, including state constitutional law. Again, that's the Supremacy Clause. Now, that leaves states basically free to do an awful lot of things until they are stopped. The default rule is that state law stays in effect unless and until Congress enacts a preemptive statute or preemptive treaty is ratified, or unless a court declares that there's a conflict between federal and state law and the state law is preempted. And that basic arrangement, while it's in some ways very brutally nationalist, much more nationalist than that of many other federal systems, also provides certain built-in protection for states because, in fact, it's not easy to enact a federal preemptive law. States and state representatives are represented in Congress. There are all the checks and balances, and there's presentment and veto and bicameralism. So it takes really extraordinary effort to enact preemptive measures at the federal level, and that means that states are free to do an awful lot of stuff. And so that's a built-in federalism protection, and that's all to the good, and that's the basic arrangement. Now, there are certain things that are so dangerous to sister states and to the federal union that the founders, in fact, broke with that general arrangement of the Supremacy Clause and said that state laws are inoperative until and unless Congress affirmatively consents to them. And those state laws are collected in Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, and among them are compacts. Article 1, Section 10 contains some absolute prohibitions against states. So, for example, they can't have treaties with one another, and Congress can't consent to a state treaty, even if it wanted to. Other measures, such as import-export duties, duties of tonnage, and the like, require congressional consent. And to repeat, that includes state compacts. No state can sign any compact with any other state or with a foreign country or with a foreign power unless Congress gives its consent. Now, at first sight, that may seem a little perplexing. What's so dangerous and bad about compacts? And in fact, there are some compacts that are sort of perfectly sensible and an efficient way of handling disputes in the federal systems. Boundary disputes, water disputes are examples. But at the same time, compacts pose, I think, two very significant dangers, and those explain why there is this special constitutional injunction against state compacts. One of them is that two or more states may conspire against a third state that's not a member of the compact, and that would break with the most elementary presuppositions of our federalisms, namely equality and non-aggression among states. That's one of them. And the other danger is that state governments are very hard to monitor for citizens, even under the best circumstances. If two or more states get together and establish some trans-state agency somewhere between the nation and the states, that thing, those beasts, those compact commissions are yet harder to monitor for citizens, and so you want to offer some protection against that. And over the history of state compacts in the United States, those deleterious effects of state compacts have in fact materialized. It would have been much, much better had the Supreme Court decided, no, we will enforce the congressional consent requirements, and we will in fact monitor these things very carefully for all sorts of complicated reasons that I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to get around to. It hasn't done so, but what one wants to remember is the founders' special fear of state compacts. There have to be some things that states are allowed to do on their own, but they are unconstitutional without congressional consent if they're done in combination or in cooperation, and I'll stop there.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, Mike and I agree on the nature of our republic. But I want to start my discussion with a quote from Federalist Number 51 from James Madison, and that quote is: "In the compound Republic of America, the power surrendered by the people is first divided between two distinct governments, and then the portion allotted to each subdivided among distinct and separate departments. Hence, a double security arises to the people. The different governments will control each other, and at the same time that each will be controlled by itself." So the fundamental structural principle that I operate from, and this is not just in Federalist 51, you can find it in Federalist 28, you can find it in Federalist 31, is that there are distinct and autonomous spheres of government authority that are allotted to the federal government and to the states. That is part of the design of the Constitution. It is not a predominantly a nationalistic form of government. It is a form of dual sovereignty. That's what the founders intended, and they intended for that division of power and that exclusive domain between the two forms of government to exist for a distinct purpose, not as an end in itself, not because we like having bullies with designated corners to stand on, but for the purpose of preserving liberty. Now, the reason why I emphasize this at the outset is I think that the problem, perhaps, with Mike's understanding of the Compact Clause, and I'm saying perhaps because I'm not so sure we disagree, but we'll find out, is that he starts from a very broad claim about the Supremacy Clause. And I think that we need to understand the Supremacy Clause in light of the background principles and spirit of the Constitution, which is to preserve dual sovereignty in order for distinct and autonomous governments to impose real checks and balances on each other. And if you look at the Supremacy Clause from that background, then it sort of begs the question to say that Congress has the power to just displace anything states do in their laws and in their constitutions. You have to ask, what powers does Congress properly wield in the first place, keeping in mind the structure that the founders tried to preserve in the form of dual sovereignty? And one of the things that I think is important to consider with respect to the Compact Clause is that the prohibition on compacts falls within a clause that talks mainly about preventing states from engaging in foreign engagements, wars, protectionist measures, So right at the heart of the Compacts Clause, we see a prohibition that contextually is targeted to preventing states from stepping into the sphere, the truly exclusively reserved sphere for the federal government, really an outwardly looking sphere, a sphere of harmonizing the states, but otherwise focused on foreign relations and military action external to the country. So I think that to give a fair reading to the Compact Clause, we can't just look at the text out of context. We have to look at the text in the context of restraining each body of government to their appropriate sphere. And from that perspective, I think that the way to look at the need for congressional consent is to both look at the text and ask yourself, what sorts of things is it appropriate, given the nature of our dual sovereignty, for Congress to have the power to give consent or not give consent to? I think it is at least a respectable argument. Maybe clearly is not the right word, but it's a respectable argument to question whether Congress has the power to reserve its consent over agreements or cooperative measures between states that merely exert powers that, from an originalist perspective, were clearly reserved to the states under the 10th Amendment. And so from my perspective, the first question in analyzing whether a compact truly requires congressional consent is to ask, what is this compact doing? Is this compact simply exerting in a cooperative fashion powers that were clearly reserved to the states in the founders' vision of our system of dual sovereignty? If so, I don't really think that it is absolutely crucial or clear that Congress necessarily must consent to states doing so. I think that a very good argument can be made and should be made based on the background principles of the entire structure of our Constitution, that when states simply act within the scope of their clearly reserved powers, Congress really has nothing to say about it. So when I look at the consent provision in the Compact Clause, what I'm seeing is something similar to where the Supreme Court is currently. It's gone a little too far, but I see basically Congress properly having the power to reserve consent to compacts when compacts are literally trenching upon the sphere of autonomy or the sphere of proper authority that the federal government is supposed to have in harmonizing state relationships and in outwardly dealing with foreign relationships and military activities. And so I agree in substance with Mike's article and his various writings, his amicus filings and so forth, that it is absolutely inappropriate for states to be agreeing for collusive purposes, for protectionist purposes, for purposes that disrupt the federal government's proper role in harmonizing trade among the states or in coordinating foreign policy or, heck, even with respect to immigration policy. I agree that those kinds of compacts must secure congressional consent. However, I don't believe that states, if they, for example, enter into an agreement to wield their sovereign powers in a cooperative fashion, and I'm not talking disputable or controversial sovereign powers, let's say things like their police powers. If they agree to exercise their criminal law enforcement activities cooperatively and to memorialize that in a compact, I just don't see a proper role for Congress to presume to have the power to stop that kind of agreement through the Compacts Clause. To presume that Congress would have the power to stop that kind of agreement is to presume that Congress was intended to have power to invade the reserved powers of the states that I believe the founders tried very clearly to reserve exclusively to the states. Now, we could talk about where the case law has gone since the founding, but the bottom line for me is if states use their sovereign powers to do what has been clearly reserved to them cooperatively, I do not see a role for Congress to interpose itself in those cooperative arrangements. On the other hand, if states do try to use their sovereign powers to disrupt harmony among the states, to engage in protectionism, to engage in collusion, to strike deals with foreign nations, to set up different immigration policies and so forth, then I believe Mike is entirely correct.
Michael Grieve, you want to have a response or anything further?
No, I think we do disagree. And here's the reason. Look, much of what Nick just said, I agree with. But there are two arguments, I think, to the contrary, and they both go to the whose judgment should it be whether something is sort of within the reserved powers of the states or not. Okay, if the distinction Nick wants to draw were to apply, or if the founders intended it to apply to compacts, the entire compact clause would no longer be needed, because you could always reach those kinds of state agreements under the Commerce Clause or some other enumerated powers. The point of the Commerce Clause is of the Compact Clause is precisely to invert the general proposition. The general proposition that Nick stated is absolutely correct, but they thought that no, with respect to compacts, we want to invert this agreement and reserve the judgment of whether this is within their state powers or not, or whether it's objectionable or not. We want to reserve that to Congress in the first instance. And there are reasons, because there is this huge gray area where, in fact, you're not certain whether this is purely internal to a state or not. Let me give you a practical example, okay? And which has some practical relevance as well. There's a famous case well known to antitrust lawyer called Parker versus Brown. So California, which at the time, this was during the Second World War, supplied something like 98% of the nation's, or 95% of the nation's raisin markets, says, we hereby we restrict the supply and raise the price of raisins across the nation. And since there weren't easy substitutes, the rest of the country paid the monopoly overcharge. And the Supreme Court said that's perfectly okay for a number of reasons, but among other things, it said California here is regulating only the production of raisins and not their interstate commerce in raisins, and so therefore that's okay, and that's within their police powers. Hallelujah. Now, whatever you make of that decision, and I happen to think it's egregious and it's wrong, but let's say sort of as a matter of sort of states' rights, police power, all the rest of it, that's right. Does it therefore follow that for a commodity that's not concentrated in a single state, but let's say five states supply the entire national supply of that particular commodity, potatoes or what have you, can they then get together and say, hey, we'll create a cartel like that? And we will then defend it on the grounds that this was all sort of pursuant to our internal police powers? And I think the answer to that is no, and it has to be no, because once two states do it together, it's no longer purely internal. It's no longer purely an exercise of the local police power. It is by definition an act in interstate commerce, and so we leave it incumbent upon Congress to sort this stuff out, and I think that's the right default rule.
Nick Dronius, do you have more to say before we go to the
audience? Yeah, I think it's important to read the actual compact clause in context to see why I think that we're being narrowly focused on the text outside of the actual context of both the provision and its historical meaning. It says, quote, no state shall, without consent of Congress, lay any duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships of war in peace, enter into any agreement or compact with another state or with a foreign power, or engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. Now, that's an entire sentence in which all of those concepts are clearly regarded as somehow unified in principle. And frankly, I don't think you can interpret that clause as fundamentally being directed to states exercising their own internal sovereign powers. It's fundamentally all about ensuring that states don't trench on the federal government's job in harmonizing relationships among the states and with external affairs. That's what it's really all about. So if, in fact, a compact turns out to in any way trench upon the federal government's role in harmonizing relationships among the states, then it's an appropriate role for someone to go to a federal court and make the case that this is the sort of compact that requires congressional consent. And you know what? The federal government has the advantage, because I don't dispute that ultimately the federal court system would decide these issues, and obviously venue matters. But the bottom line is I don't believe that you can read this clause and read into it, given the overall context of this clause and the background principles of the Constitution, the assumption that any and all compacts dealing with any and all subjects are presumptively invalid unless approved by Congress. It's not what I believe this section of the Constitution was trying to accomplish.
Okay, with that, let's open up the floor for questions from the audience. Let's go to the first question.
Hi, this is David Forte from Cleveland State. Regarding the other elements of the clause, laying a duty of tonnage, keeping troops, ships of war, are there any examples where that has occurred and Congress has approved that? Was that before the Civil War? Was that anything appropriate that besides the Compact Clause in which that entire clause has had some purchase?
Well, it's approved a lot of compacts. I think there are a few examples under the Import and Export Clause, albeit quite some time ago. If I may, this is sort of a nice segue into something Nick said earlier, and now that it comes up again, I do want to say a word about it. Look, the tonnage clause is a perfect example of why I think the broader interpretation that I defend is correct, okay? And it's this. It is not at all clear what exactly it is a tax on tonnage or, let's say, a property tax. There's a case 2-3 years ago, Polar Tankers versus City of Valdez, which hangs on that question. And if you say, no, let the states march forward as they do under the Supremacy Clause in general, and then let somebody sue over it, or then let Congress come back, you've just reinverted, so to speak, the constitutional arrangement that Article 1, Section 10 contemplates. No. Once these things, it's almost like antitrust law itself, okay? Once the merger is completed, it's very, very hard to unmake it. And precisely to liberate Congress from having to unmake something that is a fait accompli on the ground, precisely to liberate individual plaintiffs from the need to, you know, contest something that ought to be unconstitutional and unlawful without congressional consent at the front end, precisely to that end, the clause inverts the ordinary presumption, and that's why it says any. And you can't just reinvert this and say, no, let them march forward first and then let somebody contest it, because in that case, you wouldn't need the entire structure of Article 1, Section 10. So to answer David's question directly, most of the consent exercises that I'm aware of have, in fact, come under the compact piece of Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3. There are very few examples that I'm aware of with respect to the other pieces of it.
Nick?
I'm enjoying this conversation a lot because I think it really shows the importance of keeping context in reading the text of the Constitution. I think the best case to see how the Supreme Court has correctly addressed this issue is the case of Alden, which struck down a federal law that would have presumed to force states to entertain lawsuits in their own court system. In that case, there wasn't any dispute that in a purely out-of-context textual way, there just wasn't any dispute that the federal government had the apparent legal authority to compel this litigation in state courts. And what happened was that Justice Kennedy had to step back and say, but hold on a second, you have to take into consideration the entire framework of our Constitution and the need to preserve an autonomous region for states so that they can serve their function of checking and balancing federal power. And Kennedy basically said, we can't look at the text and interpret it in ways that undermines the entire background understanding of the Constitution and undermines the ability of states to effectively exert their autonomous powers consistently with the spirit and intent of the Constitution. And so he found that that the 11th Amendment, even though it technically textually didn't apply in that context, if you just looked at only the text and didn't consider the background understanding, he still found that the principles of sovereign immunity embraced by the 11th Amendment prevented federal laws that would force states to entertain lawsuits in their own courts. So when I look at this argument with Mike, I see a similar thing going on. He is drilling into the text of any agreement, just like the proponents of suing, forcing states to entertain lawsuits in their own courts were drilling into the express text of the 11th Amendment in Alden. And he's not stepping back and keeping in mind the overall goal or premise of the Constitution, which is to reserve to states their traditional sovereign powers and not invert a presumption in favor of those in traditional sovereign powers. And so I think that, again, the key question in assessing the need for congressional consent is to examine the subject matter of the compact. If a strong case can be made that a compact is disrupting the harmony among the states or in any way interfering with external affairs, I think that means clearly Congress's consent is needed. Otherwise, I don't think that the right presumption, given the framework that the founders tried to establish of dual sovereignty, is to presume that states don't have the power to do something.
Let me ask you, either one of you, I assume that these Congress expresses its approval by a simple majority vote in both houses. Is that correct?
That is, in fact, somewhat controversial.
Okay, you can say more.
Yeah.
About-
Yeah. Okay. So what does congressional approval mean? There are two rival interpretations. One is the one you just outlined, that is consent in both houses or concurrent consent in both houses. That's fine. The other interpretation is what congressional consent here means is consent in the form in which the federal legislature commonly approves legislation, and that means subject to presentment and veto. And that has been the general practice since the 1930s. There's been some discussion about what exactly, which exactly is the right position here. My own view, which I know Nick disagrees with, is that it does in fact require, congressional approval requires presentment and veto, but I recognize full well that there are these two conflicting varying interpretations out there.
You know, if I may just jump in on that really quick, if we have time. I think that the way to think about why presentment may not be necessary is to ask yourself, does the Constitution ever give law-like power to conferred bodies without presentment? And the answer is yes. It does it in the case of most obviously exercising Article 5 powers for Congress to propose amendments. It does so, maybe with presentment, but without the full normal lawmaking process when it comes to treaties which don't involve the House. So there are numerous instances, and there are others, and there are numerous instances where the Constitution gives law-like or quasi-law-like making power to a designated branch or a designated branch or two of government without all of the normal accoutrements of the lawmaking process. So it is strange, but it's not unprecedented to say that something that could have the properties of law it wouldn't go through the entire normal lawmaking process, including presentment. But theoretically, it's less troubling when I think of it this way, particularly when states are primarily exercising powers that perhaps trench a little bit on the federal government, but not all that much. And to think of it as Congress standing down. In other words, Congress is not so much passing a law as it is yielding to an exertion of state sovereignty in areas where Congress normally would have domain. And if you think of it that way, instead of a lawmaking process, I think it's easier to sort of conceptualize why presentment wouldn't be necessary. After all, it is Congress that originates laws. If it's not actually passing a law, but just yielding ground, it's not readily apparent that there needs to be a presentment role in it.
This is Dean Reuter again. Let me ask you one other question. And say that Congress passes a fairly comprehensive legislative scheme, not unlike the Affordable Care Act, and it has certain requirements that it places on states. But then a handful of states, at least two or more, get together in the wake of that successfully passed legislation and want to come up with their own cooperative health care regime they agree to it, they get Congress to agree to it, to consent to it, and there is or is not presentment. What prevails there? Does the original congressional act prevail, or does the subsequent compact prevail?
That's why I believe that presentment is required, because very frequently these enactments, you know, compact approvals will interact, certainly in modern times, but this is not a function of sort of modern complexity or overreach. It dates back a long, long time. Frequently, these compacts will interact in many, many ways with pre-existing or yet to be passed federal statutes. Think of water compacts. Think of agricultural compacts such as dairy compacts, okay? All of those occur and are approved in a larger statutory context. And it's then very, very awkward to say that, well, Congress as a whole can enact a statute and that's subject to presentment and veto, but if Congress subsequently wants to amend it or exempt states from it, the president is out of the picture and the entire process is short-circuited. I think that's quite an awkward way to look at it on balance. Just sort of a footnote to this, there's a parallel in the Constitution to the language of the Compact Clause, which has to do with state legislators' appointment of electors, right? In such a manner as the legislature of each state shall provide. Well, it shall provide under or pursuant to Bush versus Gore in such a way as the state legislature ordinarily enacts legislation. And that means with the governor's consent. And I think that's the right interpretation there, and it would be the right interpretation here. But I should emphasize I'm not nearly as dogmatic about that as I am about my sort of first-cut approach to the compact clause.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't want to sound like I'm arguing on both sides of the fence here, but the more that a compact looks like an ordinary piece of legislation and the less it looks like Congress just getting out of the way of states exercising their sovereignty in ways that, you know, incidentally trench on federal power, the less comfortable I am with the idea that there wouldn't be a presentment role. On the other hand, treaties are pretty weird too, right? I mean, a treaty can clearly trump a prior federal law, even though the House didn't have a piece of it.
Right.
So there are weird things that are authorized by the Constitution. The custom and practice under the Compacts Clause has been especially weird in that from the very beginning, there's been a doctrine of implied consent. So that even, you know, early on, it was viewed that compacts were the law of the nation. And yet, by mere implied consent, the Supreme Court was content from the 18 teens all the way to the present date to say that Congress, you know, effectively gave its consent. So obviously you can't enact laws by implication, and to the extent that an implied consent is the justification for giving something the status of a federal law, it obviously didn't have any real presentment to it. So this is just an intrinsically strange area of law. I've looked all over the ratification debates. I've looked all over, you know, Ferens and Elliott's, and it's really troubling. There is just not a whole lot of explanation of what the form would be for Congress to approve of compacts. And I think that Joseph Story himself wrote in his treatise that it was kind of curious that we don't know exactly how Congress should do this. So it's one of those inherent, I think, mysteries that's only going to be resolved through court action.
We do have somebody indicating a question, so let's go to them next.
Mike and Nick, this is Kurt Levy in Washington, D.C. Just as a follow-up to Dean's question, you know, let's assume the states are trying to do something with health care that's not even, you know, not at all intended to be compatible or minor adjustment to what Congress has done, but they're doing what's been openly talked about, which is using the Compact Clause as a way to get rid of at least parts of Obamacare. You know, that makes the congressional approval part easy. I mean, you wouldn't argue that it's the states acting merely in their own sphere. But what about presidential approval there? If you don't need presidential approval, then it is a way to get around, you know, the situation we may find ourselves in a year from now, which is Republicans controlling both houses, but not the presidency. Mike, I'm going to guess that you would say that it wouldn't work, that you believe you do need the president's signature. Correct me if I'm wrong. And Nick, I don't know what you would say. But so I guess to summarize my question, I'm asking, is it a plausible way to eat away at Obamacare if we find ourselves in that situation with Republicans controlling both houses but not the presidency?
I think it's unlikely. And the reason is that I think, look, if there are things that states cannot do individually under Obamacare, but they want to do them, they most emphatically cannot do them by acting in combination or through compact, right? If anything, the compact clause forbids more than ordinary preemption principles. Now, if you want to avoid that and change that situation, then you would need, it seems to me, Congress to approve some form of amendment to the Affordable Care Act itself to create the preemption, or to create the permission and the exemption. And I don't see how that could be done by anything other than ordinary legislation, but maybe I'm missing something.
You know, let me put my policy advocate hat on and just say, I think you can tell between the arguments that Mike and I have offered that this entire area of law is wide open, or can be, even amongst ourselves, even amongst people who take the original meaning of the Constitution seriously. And in light of that, ask yourself simply from a pragmatic policy perspective, are we in the greatest danger now of state-based collusion that violates our individual liberties, or are we at the greatest danger now of a federal government that is drawing way too much power into its reach and overstepping clearly every boundary that the founders ever imagined would exist for federal power? I think most of us would agree that the latter problem is what we really face more so, not that the former isn't worthy of some consideration. And so long as a straight-face argument can be made, and I think you can make it, and I think I'm right, but so long as we agree that a straight-face plausible argument can be made, we should be using every conceivable legal doctrine that exists under the law to restrain the federal government's power and to reform it and to put it back into its box. So I think that it is entirely appropriate for groups and states to organize around compacts that are intended to use these ambiguities in the law to put the federal government back in its box. And if that means bypassing presentment, I say do it. One of the great failures of serious constitutionalists and people on the right is that they never get engaged and fight when they have the actual weapons to fight with for fear that they might not get it absolutely right. Well, sometimes in life there are risks and mysteries in interpretation, and in the meantime, you have to fall back to the fundamentals. The fundamentals are protecting individual liberty and preserving dual sovereignty. And if you know that you're doing both of those things, and yet the law itself is operationally mysterious, I say you keep moving forward.
I actually have a different view of this. I think the problem of state overreach is as serious as the problem of federal overreach, and let me give you a few examples. Nobody out there apparently wants to talk about the Tobacco Compact, the 1998 settlement. That is a permanent tax by state compacts on tobacco consumers across the country. No legislator ever voted for it. The tax is upwards of $250 billion over the first 20 years of the agreement, and it runs in perpetuity thereafter. The agreement perfectly illustrates that it isn't enough to say, okay, let states do it first, and after that, we take it apart. Because once the deal was done, states were very, very good at standing up in Congress and saying, oh, no, we did this, and that's an exercise of state rights, and how dare you mess with our money and with our agreements. And Congress did what it usually does in these situations, was to space out. you could no longer interest the courts in any of these things. The only way to stop that would have been to enforce the constitutional requirements ex ante and up front and to say, oh, no, 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 without congressional consent, you states cannot do this. And if you think that agreement was an exercise of state sovereignty, state power, state authority, go ask the states that dissented at the time. Go ask Bill Pryor, now Judge Pryor, who was screaming his head off over the aggression of the other states. Again, you cannot protect this against these kinds of arrogations of power, billions of dollars in additional taxes, without enforcing the congressional consent requirements as it is written. That is not abstracting from the constitutional structure. That is insisting on the constitutional structure. The normal arrangement is the Supremacy Clause. If there's a whole section of an article, Section 10 of Article 1, that deliberately, explicitly inverts the agreement, then that demands, it seems to me, respect, especially if there are a lot of policy arguments cutting in the same direction. I would like to add to that that there are lots of states who are agitating for state compacts and for sort of resisting the federal government and doing things on their own and enforcing their own state rights and protecting liberty. This very moment, some of them have been agitating, many of them have been agitating for the better part of 15 years for an interstate compact to tax internet transactions from one state to another. The only thing that has saved us from that is that five states say no to it. Otherwise, this thing, you know, would be motoring on and we'd all be paying God knows what over the internet. There are several other compacts that have taken the form of greenhouse gas compacts to create regional cap and trade systems that the United States Congress will not enact. They say they don't need federal approval for that kind of thing. These aren't libertarian initiatives. These aren't efforts to sort of put the federal government into its box. They all mean more government at all levels. That is why the progressives and the New Dealers were so hot to trot on compacts to begin with. That is why the 19th century was dead set against them. And my proposal is to sort of step back and go back to the original structure. I think that'll be much more libertarian than sort of this loosey-goosey position of saying, let's mobilize these things and see where we end up.
I would just add, Mike, I liked your last point. I mean, you were saying 10 years ago about federalism that a lot of the approaches we're taking to putting the federal government back in its box are sort of kludges because we're not putting them back in their box the way they should by enforcing the limits that were originally there.
Right. Let me sorry, Nick. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I this is a tactical judgment, I think, that we're all debating about. And I think at this point in history, the greater threat is not from bad tax policy being enacted through compacts or even cap and trade being regionally enacted through compacts. The greater threat is the federal government presuming to say that it can regulate you to buy a private good or service, because if it aggregates your mental decisions, it will have a substantial impact on interstate commerce. That principle sweeps so much more broadly and threatens our individual liberties and the very structure of the separation of powers, both vertically and horizontally, so much more than discrete bad ideas for taxation among the states, or even discrete collusive ideas through silly things and ridiculous and horrible things like the tobacco deal, that I just don't see the two as even in the same ballpark. I mean, we have the federal government claiming power that exceeds even the traditional understanding of the police power at the state level through Obamacare. And if we can use an ambiguous and perhaps intrinsically ambiguous area of the law for states to mobilize and allow the people to throw their weight behind state sovereignty to put a check on the federal government, that is where our first priority should be right now.
Okay. We have indications here that a couple other people have questions they'd like to ask. Go right ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Jeff Clark from Kirkland & Ellis, and I have a question for Nick, but before that, just one quick comment that it seems to me that there's not a dichotomy between whether to push for constraining federal power or whether to push for constraining state overreach, but that the two things are interconnected, especially in the environmental area, as Mike was alluding to. You know, there are a lot of ways in which California in particular presses for these kinds of expansions of authority on the state level, and then that creates a problem that then the federal government has to solve by creating more federal government. So maybe if Nick could comment on that a little bit, that would be great. But the question for Nick is, in terms of your structural interpretation of the Compact Clause as fitting in with, you know, things that go to constraining the states to their sphere as opposed to, you know, entering the federal sphere, can you give an example of what you think a good compact would be that might be on the edge and where your interpretive principle would kind of kick it into, being something that the court should approve as opposed to something that, you know, is a kind of compact like a protectionist one that you would concede, you know, should be unlawful?
Oh, well, thanks. Absolutely. I've got two model legislation that we're actually developing or have gotten approval from ALEC. The first one is what I call the sovereign state compact, where if 38 states agree to it, they will forever abandon accepting conditional federal grants that trench on their reserved sovereign powers. That would be one example. It has no collusive effects. It would merely stop the abuse of conditional federal grants. Under Mike's interpretation, it wouldn't be permitted without congressional consent. And what do you think the chances of that are? Another concept that I'm developing right now is for states to form an interstate compact to periodically meet to discuss and debate whether to return back home and introduce applications for an Article 5 convention. Again, this would be doing nothing other than coordinating the states and wielding powers conferred upon them exclusively. So in no way it trenches on federal powers or exceeds the scope of sovereignty that states have. In fact, very clearly it doesn't. And yet, under Mike's interpretation, the states would have to get congressional consent for them to organize in this fashion. I just don't think that if you take the role of the states seriously, as written in Federalist 28, for example, as a literal counterbalance to federal power, that we should be more worried about defanging the interstate compact without congressional consent than we are worried about not doing powerful, coordinated, and collective efforts from the states to check and balance federal government. I think this is a tactical position. Obviously, if you roll back to the Jim Crow era or Plessy versus Ferguson, I'd probably have a different position on which was the greater relative threat to the structure of our Constitution and to our individual liberty. But right now, I think it's beyond question that as between these two concerns, the greatest concern has to be of the excessive concentration of power in the federal government. And in relation to that, the need for states to organize so that they can serve as an effective check and balance on that aggressive federal overreach.
Jeff, did you have a follow-up? Or Mike, did you want to respond?
No, I'd like to hear what Mike's reactions to those points would be.
Oh, I don't think that either of the first two things that Nick mentioned would remotely require congressional consent. I think compacts have to be binding agreements establishing mutual obligations that are enforceable. I think any state can reject federal funding any day of the week if they want to agree to that at some ALEC convention or anywhere else. They're perfectly free to do that. The Supremacy Clause isn't remotely implicated, or the inverted Supremacy Clause by implication isn't remotely implicated in those kinds of situations. There are other things I should add that I think could be done, including in the healthcare area, that states could probably do on their own. So here's an example. I mean, or by mutual agreement, which might not require congressional consent. I'll add my caveat to that at the end. But here's what I have in mind: due to a whole lot of insurance requirements, individual or small group insurance in New Jersey is very, very expensive. It's relatively cheap in Indiana because it doesn't have all these complicated requirements and coverage requirements and so on and so forth. I think if New Jersey wanted to, it could have a reciprocity agreement with Indiana and saying, okay, so long as an insurance product can be legally sold in your state, meaning Indiana, we will also allow it to be sold in our state and in the future once they're up and running under these healthcare exchanges. That's the caveat. I don't know what I don't know the Accountable Care Act well enough to know whether that might be preempted by federal law. For reasons having nothing to do with the compact clause, but having to do with ordinary preemption principles. But if it's not, I don't see why a reciprocity agreement of that nature should require congressional consent. I recognize it's a little more complicated, and you might make an argument that no, even those kinds of agreements would require congressional consent. But that is a genuinely sort of libertarian, open market reform that states could perform on their own, and that might do an awful lot of good in the larger scheme of things. A healthcare compact among states establishing some additional commission sort of between the feds and between the state-run exchanges, and on top of everything else we have, I don't begin to see what good that could do down the road.
Yeah, if I could just add to this, I commend Mike for recognizing that there can be some forms of interstate agreements that don't require congressional consent, but then I have to just needle him a little bit, because if you look at his strict textualist approach to the Compacts Clause, it doesn't say that, you know, that bilateral agreements that we aren't going to call enforceable are exempt from congressional consent. After all, it says any agreement with another state requires congressional consent if you only look at the text and you don't keep in context that text. So, Mike, you're moving in my direction. I like the way you're moving.
No. Look, I recognize that. That's a very important point. I'm not, emphasize, not sort of a foot-stomping literalist. Any must mean any, okay? If two governors want to have breakfast together, you can say that's an agreement among states, but I can't imagine that that would require congressional consent. By the same token, if the National Governors Association wants to establish itself, you know, and have periodic meetings, that's an agreement among states of sorts, and then the NGA is funded by legislative contributions from each state. So you can say, you know, that is an agreement. Why doesn't that need congressional consent? No, I don't think it does. These have to be, I think, to fall under the Compact Clause, official acts of state. They have to be binding. And all of those requirements, I mean, I'm not larding up the clause with something that hasn't been sort of recognized for quite some time. Those things have been worked out in Supreme Court cases. Some of them, you know, other than the decisions that go to sort of this latitudinarian blah, you know, anything goes. With respect to the formal elements of what constitutes a compact, I think the Supreme Court has by and large gotten it right. The authoritative statement is Northeast Bank Corp, which I think was decided in 1978. That's where I would go with respect to what exactly is it that constitutes a compact. And once you have found that there is a compact, I would say any and all of them require congressional consent ex ante.
Looks like we have one more question from our audience, so let's see if we can get to that.
Well, thank you. This is Gilbert Zimmerman. I'm retired from the practice, calling you from Morristown, New Jersey. I've been listening to the past several conference calls with a great deal of interest, and I'm going to express a point of view that I think would possibly summarize some of the feelings that are being expressed. And I was wondering if it might actually pass muster in terms of the people who are listening today. And here is the issue. I'm wondering if there is a case that can be made that the president is actually a consistent and knowing violator of the principles of the Constitution. And are we concerned that the pattern of disregard is actually creating an environment in which the Constitution is gradually losing legitimacy as a matter of political reality? Thank you very much.
Do either of you want to respond to that? A bit off beyond our topic, but I'll give you a
Well,
chance.
I'm not sure it is. I that's really what we're. That's the.
Well, let's give the panelists
yep.
an opportunity to respond if they'd like to. Go ahead, Nick or Michael.
Nick, you want to go first?
I'll go first if you want me to.
Look, I think the sentiment you're expressing is a sentiment I feel. It animates me. It's why I wrote and Goldwater Institute published the Federalism DIY report, which pulls together 10 tactics for checking and balancing the federal government. It's because I do believe that for folks in Washington, the Constitution doesn't mean a whole lot. And so now we're left with using every available tool and shield, and it just so happens state sovereignty is one of the strongest tools and shields, to try to restore some modicum of what the Constitution was meant to stand for. So I share that sentiment. I view as interstate compacts, whether you qualify them as Mike qualifies them, whether they're congressionally approved or not, I view them as an integral tactic for states to use in order to put the federal government back in the box it needs to be in.
And I think the problem is even bigger. I completely agree with the sentiment that the caller expressed. I'm very, very worried about it, but I think it's now shared at the state level. I'll just give you one example. I worked on sort of a piece of litigation, which was a challenge to the multi-state agreement on tobacco litigation, in which the Supreme Court eventually, on compact clause grounds, in which the Supreme Court eventually denied cert. There's a wonderful amicus brief in that case. It's signed by Richard Epstein, Alan Morrison, Kathleen Sullivan, and Michael McConnell, that just about covers the ideological spectrum. And all of them say, the brief says, it's a wonderful brief. It basically says, look, the compact clause must mean something. And you characters here at the Supreme Court have read it completely out of existence by sort of emasculating the congressional consent requirement altogether. If this compact among states doesn't require congressional consent, nothing ever will require congressional consent, and that cannot possibly be right. And you can get agreement on that position from across the political spectrum, from the libertarians to the progressives. And that's the state of the Constitution that we have gotten to. Yeah, I completely agree with Nick. What is going on in Washington is actually quite scary in terms of the sort of casual contempt for constitutional forms and formalities. But I wouldn't hold out the state governments as sort of shining exemplars of constitutional respect.
For Nick and Michael, we have one more question.
Yes, Nick and Mike, this is Rick Masters with the Council of State Governments. I have admired your work, Nick, for some time, and we've talked to some of the same folks about interstate compacts and I think I agree with much of what's been said in your analysis. I did not hear all of the initial presentation, but I wanted to make sure that I didn't misunderstand Michael Grieve to be taking the position that the compact clause requires consent for all compacts, and if so, I take issue with that because I don't see how a plain reading of Virginia versus Tennessee or U.S. Steel Corporation versus Multi-State Tax Commission could possibly leave anyone with any doubt that that there are not compacts that don't require consent. So I just wanted to make sure I understood that, and if you could clarify that, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. I think the U.S. Steel versus Multi-State Tax Commission case is wrongly decided. It is plainly and categorically and unequivocally wrong. It is one of the most atrocious decisions that I've ever seen in my life on anything that has anything to do with the structure of the United States Constitution. And, you know, the time will come to put that dog of a case out of its misery. That's my considered position.
So on Marbury versus Madison grounds, you're not saying that's not the law of the land as the Supreme Court has stated it, but you disagree with what they said?
Yes. Correct.
Hey, thanks.
Look, the decision is out there. That doesn't mean that the rest of us can't disagree with it. And
I agree with you, and I could give you a list of constitutional decisions that I feel the same way about on other topics. So.
Right.
Just to clarify my position and how it differs from Mike's, I don't think the core of U.S. Steel's decision is wrong. To the extent that U.S. Steel says that states, when they act within their reserve sovereign powers and they do not attempt to augment those powers, entrench on federal powers that are clearly delegated to the federal government, that they can compact over that. I don't have any problem with that aspect of the holding. What I have a problem is extensions of that holding or in loose language in that holding that suggests that even collusive or protectionist compacts between the states don't require congressional consent. Because on that point, I am in total agreement with Mike. There is no doubt that states gave up in ratifying the Constitution any power to engage in protectionist or collusive measures that could disrupt harmony among the states with respect to trade. And so to me, I am four square with Mike on the idea that congressional consent is necessary for any collusive or protectionist compact, notwithstanding U.S. Steel. And I think that both U.S. Steel was loose in its language to the extent that it can be interpreted to justify that, and any extension of it is erroneous.
Terrific. Well, let me, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank our call-in audience for your questions today and for dialing into our call. And, of course, I also want to thank Michael Greva and Nick Dronius for their remarks and their responses today. We are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.